shook her head. "Get your muscled ass in here, sir. Your princess commands it." Terin ducked his head and entered, and Moira closed the door behind him. When he didn't move from the entrance, Moira said, "Eat your soup before it gets cold, sir."
"Arm. You can call me Arm," Terin said.
Anise thought he looked like a lost giant. She stood and grabbed his arm, dragging him to the table and pulling him into a chair, which creaked under his weight. Moira pushed a bowl in front of him, filled to the brim.
"Can I take your helmet?"
"No,"
Terin said. Moira raised an eyebrow.
"It's going to be awfully hard to eat through your mask."
"Sorry,"
Anise said.
"But can you give us a few minutes alone so he can eat?"
"Gladly,"
Killorn said, glaring at them and stomping toward the door.
"I'll get back to work loading my cart."
He left, slamming the door behind him.
"Don't mind him,"
Moira said.
"He has trouble showing appreciation for anything."
"I don't blame him,"
Terin said, his voice low.
"I'm going to check on Killorn,"
Moira said. She moved to the door, and only once she'd pulled the door shut behind her did Terin reach for the bottom of his mesh face cover.
"Turn away," he said.
"Terin, I've already seen—"
"Turn away, Anise. Please."
Anise pursed her lips, but obeyed. She didn't hear the clank of his spoon, just the barest hint of someone drinking. Less than a minute later, he said,
"We should go."
She spun around to find his bowl empty, licked clean, his face mask once more covering him.
"You can have seconds," she said. "I did."
"I'm not hungry,"
he said.
"And we need to move on so we can get closer to Gearhead before dark."
"Terin, we should talk about what happened—"
"Anise,"
Terin said, cutting her off.
"I can't. Not now."
"Then when?"
"Maybe never,"
he said. He started to get up, but Anise grabbed his shoulder. Terin's eyes flicked to her hand and then back to her face.
"I'm not your judge, jury, or executioner," she said.
"Then what are you?"
"I was a friend once. Maybe I can be one again."
"I don't have friends,"
Terin said.
"What about Sir Dietrich? You let him defeat you in the melee, did you not?"
"What? No. He bested me with his valor and swordsmanship."
"I don't doubt his ability,"
Anise interrupted.
"But you didn't fight to your full potential. Not the way you did against those four soldiers."
"Clever,"
Terin said.
"But you're not getting me to talk about that. Maybe I didn't fight as long or as hard as I could have in the melee. But if I had, I still would have lost. There's more to Sir Dietrich than a quick sword."
Anise remembered how her uncle had stripped him naked. She remembered all the scars.
"You lost control, so what?"
Anise said.
"It happens. I lose control all the time. Once I practically neutered a smug lordling from Darin, who tried to kiss me after complimenting my hind parts."
Though she couldn't see it, Anise could sense Terin's lips curling into a smile.
"I'm walking out that door, and I hope you'll follow me,"
he said, pushing his chair back and standing.
"Maybe you are made from stone,"
Anise muttered. But if Terin heard, he pretended not to. However, before he could reach the door, it opened, a gust of snowy wind blasting inwards. Moira and her husband stepped inside. Moira said,
"Killorn has something he wants to tell you."
Killorn grunted and stared at his boots. Moira jabbed him with her elbow, and he glared at her. Then he spoke.
"Thank you for what you've done, saving the missus and me."
He rubbed his bald head, adding,
"And for not choking me dead."
Moira slapped him in the back of his head and said,
"What else?"
He shook his head, and she pinched his arm.
"Frozen hell, woman! I'm getting to it!"
"Getting to what?"
Anise asked.
"An offer. I'll be heading to Gearhead in the morn. You may ride along in my cart if you see fit."
With that, he spun around and headed back to the barn. Moira grinned.
"Well,
What say ye?
We appreciate all your kindness, Taryn said.
But I, Anise said. We say I.
Taryn turned around to glare at her, but Anise only offered a huge smile. She was hell-frozen tired of walking.
Do you have a nearby stream or river? Taryn asked suddenly. Even a creek or pond will do.
Anise frowned at him, wondering when his manners had shriveled up and died. For the last few hours he'd said nothing, as Moira made small conversation with Anise. The kindly woman had tried to include Taryn, but had given up after he'd provided no more than one-word grunted answers in return, staring broodily at the crackling fire. Killorn wasn't present, having excused himself to prepare the wagon for the following day's journey to Gearhead.
Aye, Moira said with a smile.
She seemed happy to finally have something to talk to Taryn about.
A pond, our source of fresh water.
Have you ever streamed messages from it? Taryn asked.
Course. We get news from the castle from time to time, and we communicate with our timber buyers, for my fool of a husband travels there.
Would you mind if I use a few Gearhead inkreeds?
Who do you know in Gearhead? Anise asked.
A woman,
Taryn said cryptically, glancing at Moira.
I get the hint, Moira said. A secret, then. Never fear. I will gather a pot of ink from our reeds for you.
Thank you, Taryn said.
When she'd gone, Anise said,
What woman?
A friend of your aunt's. She lives in Gearhead.
Are you certain she's trustworthy?
Taryn nodded, but didn't say more as Moira returned with a pot of ink, a long black quill, and a torn sheet of wrinkled parchment.
Sorry, but this'll have to do. Parchment ain't cheap, so we reuse it.
It's perfect. Thank you,
Taryn said. He situated the paper and ink before himself on the table, and then gently dipped the business end of the quill into the pot.
What is the known name of your pond's ink reeds?
Moira said,
Moira's Pond. They use it in Gearhead. 'Tis the only place we send streams to.
When Taryn raised his eyebrows, she added,
Killorn don't know his letters, so I do all the writing. You're a good woman,
Anise said.
That's me, she said. A real catch.
She smiled.
I'll leave you to it.
Anise watched as Taryn inked a cryptic letter to his contact in Gearhead. A woman named Netta. About a hope flower blooming in the city the following day. He signed it A.K. and included Moira's Pond as the return location.
Are you the blooming hope flower, or am I?
Anise asked, her lips curling on each side.
Do I look like someone who wears pink?
Taryn said.
Do I?
Anise retorted.
It's not meant to be taken literally. We came up with the code a while ago, when Zelda was making plans. The hope flower was her idea. Let's go.
Anise felt something warm in her chest at the notion, as she followed Taryn to the door. At the same time, she wondered what Archer's code name was. Outside the cottage, Moira and Killorn were loading up a wagon with timber and supplies. Taryn opened his mouth to speak, but Moira waved him off, pointing down the snowy slope eastward. They trudged through the snow in the direction Moira had indicated, until they came to a small iced-over lake. It was easy to spot the small pod of inkreeds growing on the embankment beside the frozen water. Taryn started to bend down by the edge, but Anise stopped him with a hand on his arm.
"Can we talk about what happened earlier?" she asked.
"No."
He pulled his arm away, locating a sharp stone, presumably to break the ice with.
"Taryn..."
"What, Anise? Do you want to know about how the thing inside me screamed in my head as I fought? How fires burned through my veins? How my muscles were ready to snap, to choke, to pummel anything and everything nearby? Or how about the cold and the emptiness I felt in my chest when it was over, when the strength and adrenaline left me, when I was all alone again? Is that what you want me to say?"
"Yes," Anise said. Terin looked back sharply over his shoulder. Then he sighed.
Look, I might not be able to understand exactly what it feels like to be you, but I want to understand. You don't have to be alone, Terin. Not any more.
He began chipping away at the ice, which broke off in chunks.
I will always be alone.
He cleared a large enough hole in the ice directly in front of the thatch of Inkreeds to fit his message into. Anise watched him as he worked, how tenderly he handled the sheet of parchment, his giant gloved hands as agile as a seamstress's. She could hardly imagine the man before her was the same man who'd brutalized four soldiers without breaking a sweat. He dipped the parchment into the cold water, holding it under for a few moments. Slowly, the ink faded away until it vanished completely, leaving the parchment wet and clear. Although Anise had streamed hundreds of messages herself, usually requesting the results of tournaments across the realm, the process still amazed her. How the ink could travel such great distances through water, only to reform in the exact letters and words in which it was written. Somewhere in Gearhead, wherever the ink was harvested from, the message would appear in the water, only to be transferred to parchment and delivered to this Netta woman. "How long do you think it will take her to respond?" Anise asked, as Terin gathered up the wet parchment and laid it out to dry in the snow. Terin said,
"You're not going to argue about what I said before?"
Anise shrugged.
"I can't change your mind. Only you can change your mind. In any case, you're not alone now, even if you think you are."
His eyes met hers, and he shook his head.
"I've never met anyone quite like you."
She laughed.
Was that an attempt at a compliment?
Before he could respond, she added,
"Anyway, you have met someone like me. Me. About 10 years ago, remember? We ran, I rubbed snow in your face. You cried."
Finally, he laughed. And Anise was acutely aware how much she'd missed that sound, a deep rumble that seemed to originate deep in his chest.
"I could never forget you," he said, "or the snow being rubbed in my face."
She was considering her next jape when something caught her eye.
"Look,"
she said, pointing at the hole in the ice. In the water, words were forming. They were difficult to read as they bounced and churned on the crests of tiny wavelets. Terin placed the damp paper back in the water, and the ink immediately stuck to it. When he withdrew it, Anise peered over his shoulder. The message was short.
"I'll pick some hope flowers tomorrow, then. Come hungry. Netta."
"Come hungry," Anise said. "Is that another code for something?"
Terin laughed.
"No. In this case, Netta means exactly what she says. She's the best damn cook I know."
Anise's stomach rumbled. Moira's thin soup had done little to sate her appetite. Despite having been given the lumpy bed and getting the best sleep she'd had since fleeing Castle Hill, Anise had been surprised to find herself missing sharing the little tent with Terin, feeling his arm tight and warm against her, her body nestled within his gargantuan frame.
"Frozen hell, I'm pathetic," she thought,
as he offered her a hand up onto the timber-laden cart. His face mask was smudged with something ash-dark. During the night, she'd woken once, in the darkness, and heard a soft sound arising from Terin's large form. Crying. He'd been crying. She'd listened to his muffled sobs for a few moments, wondering whether she should go to him, to comfort him, but then they'd stopped.
"I will always be alone."
His words from the pond the day before continued to unsettle her. She'd rolled over and gone back to sleep. Now she ignored his hand and used brute strength to haul herself aboard. She turned back and provided her own hand to pull him up beside her. He shook his head.
"My lady is in a queer mood this morning."
"Your lady got cold last night."
It was a lie, but after a good night's sleep, she was feeling exceptionally bold.
"It was plenty warm next to the fire," he said.
Terrin had slept, sprawled out like a cat beside the hearth, refusing to remove a single plate of his armour, even when Moira had offered a large blanket to cover him.
"What is he saying?" Anise wondered.
That she should have joined him beside the fire. She hated that she could never read his expressions because of his damned mask. He made his way toward the front of the cart, where Killorn had created an empty space within the stacked timber. It would be tight, but they would fit well enough to remain hidden should anyone happen upon the cart on the road to Gearhet. Terrin slid in first, squirming to one side so Anise could follow. She dropped inside, propping her back against the rough wood. It would be a long, uncomfortable ride to the castle, but it would be better than traipsing through the thick coat of fresh snow that had fallen overnight. Killorn's face appeared above them.
"If anyone stops us, shut your traps," he barked. "Once we arrive, I'll find a place for you to slip away. Then I ne'er want to see your faces again. You hear?"
Moira's face appeared next to his, and she said,
"What my loving husband means is that we appreciate what you've done for us, and this is how we repay our debt."
"Thank you," Anise said.
"But your debt is already paid."
"Then why are we hauling you to—"
Killorn started to say, but was cut off when his wife jabbed his ribs with a finger.
"We're honoured to be of service to a princess of the North," Moira said.
Their faces disappeared, and were soon replaced by several wooden boards, which covered the hole, allowing only thin slits of light to peek through. Wind whistled between the timber as Killorn said,
"Get up, lasses!"
And the cart lurched forward, hauled by a trio of grizzled grey ponies. The snowy road was bumpy, and soon Anise was almost regretting her decision to accept a ride. Twice she banged her head on the timber and cursed, and twice Terrin chuckled.
"You should wear armour," he said, "like me."
"To hide my face,"
Anise snapped back, rubbing her bruised scalp. A goose egg was already rising from her skin. Terrin went quiet for a moment and then said,
"Your words wound me, my queen. Maybe you are not what the lordlings of Castle Hill call traditional beauty. But you are beautiful all the same."
Anise practically choked. It was the last thing she expected him to say. The last thing she expected anyone to say. She remembered what he'd said before about her tendency to hide behind self-deprecating japes, as 100 sprang to mind. She chose one of her favourites.
"The Princess of the North is so robust that if she stretched out, she could insulate half of Castle Hill."
"At least you're not scrawny."
"The Princess of the North once bested a royal steed with both hands bound behind her back. How, you might ask? She sat on him."
"At least you're not weak."
Anise was on a roll and not about to stop now.
"The Princess of the North once devoured an entire royal feast in one sitting, and then she ate the plates and silverware, not to mention the table and chairs."
"A healthy appetite, by my reckoning," Terrin said.
Anise finally stopped, unable to hold back her laughter. Once the very quips she'd just spoken had wounded her deeply, but now they seemed so unimportant. Such small things. Frozen hell, she'd fought off an ice bear.
"Why do you defend me? Because we knew each other once?"
"No," Terrin said. "Because we know each other now. Because I see the snowstorms in your eyes. Because you were worth it then, and you still are, my Queen of the North."
Anise was dead glad to be able to hide in the shadows of their tiny crawl space, her face turning as red as the rising sun. Before he could embarrass her further, she went on the offensive.
"And what of you?" she said. "You hide your true self behind dark armour, making the world believe you're a monster."
"Maybe what they believe is true."
His voice sounded like it had descended into a deep pit.
"Why? Because you fight like a champion of the North."
Terrin said nothing.
"Why were you crying last night?"
Anise asked.
Silence for a moment, and then, "I'm sorry you heard me. I'm sorry I disturbed your sleep."
Sleep be damned. Answer my question.
I was mourning.
Whom? Anise asked, but then had a thought. My mother.
Yes.
Fresh anger, as hot and bright as the sun, burst inside her veins.
You don't get to mourn her. Not you.
I loved her as much as my own mother,
Taryn said. Anise squeezed her fists until her fingernails bit into her palms. The familiar urge to launch herself at him was there. It wasn't fair that he should love a woman she'd always tried to love. Sabria Loren was her mother, not his. But the way he'd cried for her, his secret tears spilling through the night like a dark waterfall. The anger shredded itself into ribbons of sorrow. She couldn't imagine what he was feeling. He'd killed someone he'd loved. The order wasn't his, and someone else would have done it if he hadn't, but still. He'd kicked the platform away. He'd been close enough to catch her body before the rope tightened around her neck. But he hadn't. Taryn had watched her mother die, and then he'd saved her niece and her brother, Sir Dietrich, too. All because it was what the Queen commanded him to do.
I don't expect you to forgive me, Taryn said. Everything I am is darkness. Even my tears are black.
The ashy smudges on his face mask, she realized. Dried tears from the night before. I'm trying to understand, Anise admitted.
There's nothing to understand. I'm a dangerous man, but not to you. Never to you.
It was Anise's turn to remain silent, unable to find the words, her tears threatening to cascade like clear waterfalls down pale cliffs.
I almost killed Killorn,
Taryn eventually said.
An innocent man.
Adrenaline and bloodlust, Anise said. Nothing more.
Was she really defending him?
Yes, and maybe he deserved it.
Thin lines of light carved his helmet into pieces as he shook his head.
I lost control. The thing inside me was the only voice I could hear.
And then you heard mine, Anise said.
And if you hadn't been there?
I was there.
But if you weren't, I would have killed him. So what does that make me?
Imperfect, Anise said. Human. You can't control everything. You can't control the disease that afflicted you as a child. You can't control that the witch had to curse you to save you. All you can do is take what you've been given and live.
Taryn sighed.
I will, if you will.
I already am, Anise insisted. I'm here. I'm fighting.
No, you're not, Taryn said. You're off in the hinterlands, hiding from your destiny. That's what you keep talking about, aye?
So what? I don't want to be a princess. I don't want to be a queen. I don't want to rule the north. Why can't I choose another path?
Taryn grasped her hand with his gloved fingers, his grip fierce and firm.
Because that's not who you are.
What do you know of me? You've been gone for years. As a child, I mourned your death. You were my friend. And you left me.
Not by choice.
You could have said goodbye. You could have told me something. Not let my mother lie about what happened to you.
I was just a child. I was scared of my own skin, of the darkness flowing through my veins. I still am.
Anise knew he was right and that she wasn't being fair.
I'll find Arch and convince him to leave the kingdom forever. Let my uncle tear the north apart in his war with the other three kingdoms. Frozen hell! I don't care if he's victorious and anoints himself king of the entire four kingdoms, as long as I don't have to be a prisoner in Castle Hill any longer.
You don't mean that. And anyway, Arch will never leave the kingdom.
He will. He must. I lost a brother once. I won't lose another.
What?
Taryn said, his tone full of surprise.
What brother?
Anise clamped her mouth shut, annoyed that in the heat of the argument she'd said more than she wanted to.
Nothing. It's not important.
You had another brother. I've never heard about another prince.
He died as an infant. It was kept secret from the realm. Dead royals are considered bad luck.
What was his name?
The question took Anise by surprise. Why did his name matter?
My parents hadn't decided. He was 3 days old when he was killed.
Murdered?
Anise swallowed a lump in her throat. She'd mourned the loss of her brother for days and months and years. The truth was, she'd never gotten over him, not really.
When I said I bore no scars, I lied, Anise said.
Who would kill an infant?
Wolves, she said,
the word sticking in her throat. Her mouth tasted bitter.
A door to the nursery was left unlocked and ajar, as well as an outer door. My mother had only been gone for a moment, but that was all it took.
Anise realized Taryn's hand was still clutching hers. She pulled away, both from his hand and from the topic of her dead brother.
Help me or not. That is your choice. But I will flee to the hinterlands.
If that is truly what you want, I will help you.
The road bumped. The wind whistled through the timber. Anise cursed under her breath.
Damn you for being so gallant all the time.
Taryn chuckled.
I've been called many things, but never gallant.
A gallant monster,
Anise said.
Sounds like an awful bedtime story,
Taryn said.
Shh!
Anise hissed. She'd heard hoofbeats and shouts. 22. The Eastern Kingdom, approaching Glee. Rhone. Apparently, Gwendolyn's opinion meant much to the king, because now Rhone found himself riding beside her and a dozen scouts, heading for the small way station called Glee, which had been overrun by the eastern disease known simply as the pox, or occasionally as mottle, a flesh-eating illness that was known to twist the minds of its victims. The king and the princes would not risk coming within a league of the town.
Great, he thought. My life can be summed up as from the plague to the pox.
At least he was fairly certain there would be no dragons, two-headed or otherwise, to contend with. When the edges of the ramshackle town appeared in the distance, the scouts reined their horses to a stop. Tendrils of grey smoke curled from the roofs of several of the town's structures.
A good sign, Rhone thought.
At least the people are well enough to build fires in their hearths.
"War speed,"
one of the scouts said, an eastern wish for good luck and success. Gwen nodded to Rhone and dismounted.
"We cannot risk the horses. The disease spares no living creature."
Rhone followed her lead, handing his ropes to one of the scouts. Gwen strode forward, ever fearless. Rhone scurried after her, nearly tripping on the thick tufts of grass sprouting from the hillside. Glee was nestled in an emerald valley, a long narrow river snaking down the gradual decline and swooping along the edge of the town. Blades of sunlight snuck past the clouds, which made the flowing waters sparkle like newly forged steel. Rhone veered off toward the stream, his mouth suddenly dry. He cupped his hands in the cool, clear water, bringing it up toward his mouth.
"Do not drink," Gwen cautioned. "We do not know where the pox originated. The water may carry the disease."
Rhone stopped, and when he looked at the water, it now seemed dark and foreboding. He let it spill between his fingers, which he rubbed dry on the grass.
"Thank you for the warning." "I did it for the people of Glee," Gwen said, turning away. "They need what you can offer."
"What can I offer?" Rhone wondered. He didn't truly know what he was capable of. The urge to flee from the town was like a stone wall pushing him back. Gwen turned and glared at him.
"Time is of the essence," she said.
Rhone forced one foot after the other,
each step feeling more difficult than the one prior. Still, he managed to catch up to the Orion when she slowed.
"Will your mark protect you from the pox?" he asked.
She shook her head.
"No, but you will."
"What?" A flood of fear washed over him, as if the stream had burst its banks and crashed upon his shoulders. He couldn't let her life be in his hands.
"No, stay here. I will go into the town alone," he said. "The pox changes people."
She pointed to her head.
"The afflicted see things that aren't there. They're unpredictable and dangerous. You can't protect yourself and help them at the same time. I'm coming."
Her words were as firm and unmoving as the trees of ironwood, rooted in the metallic ground. When she spoke them, the mark on her cheek blazed to life momentarily, and then flickered out.
"What power does your mark give you?" Roan asked again. "And why would it show itself when you merely spoke?"
"That is not your concern," Gwen said. She started forward once more, the town a mere stone's throw away now. Again, Roan followed, the smell of smoke growing thicker and more pungent with each step. That's when he saw the flames, bright red and orange tongues licking the tops of several of the wooden structures. What he'd originally thought was smoke from hearth fires was in reality a raging inferno devouring the town. Roan tried to call out to Gwen to wait, but she had already slipped between the first two buildings on the edge of town. He hustled to catch up, sidling up beside her at the corner of a wooden structure that was, thankfully, not on fire. What he saw turned his skin to goose flesh. A woman ran across what was likely once a thriving marketplace, screaming. Flames swept up her legs, torso, and chest. She was chased by a man brandishing a torch. He caught her, slamming it into her back. She fell, and he landed atop her, the flames sweeping over him in a rush as a stiff gust of wind hit them. Another man, shirtless, his muscles bulging, wielded a blacksmith's sledge. He was swinging it wildly at anything and anybody that moved. Dead chickens, hogs, and humans lay strewn about him.
"Devils!" he roared with each swing. "Devils! Devils! Devils!"
Other afflicted townsfolk were committing equally horrifying atrocities. A flock of children, their mouths contorted in fierce snarls, surrounded a man who seemed remarkably lucid, trying to hold them off with a metal frying pan. The children threw sharp stones, pelting the man's face and body, blood pouring from each wound.
"Help!"
the man screamed, to no one in particular. If there were any other people not taken by the pox, they were ignorant to his cries.
"We're too late," Roan thought.
He began to back away from the carnage, even as Gwen sprang forward. Roan tried to grab her arm, but she was already gone, moving with blinding speed through the square, dodging flames and blunt weapons swung by delirious hands. Roan was frozen in place, only able to watch as she leapt the circle of stone-throwing children, grabbed the man around the waist, and retreated. The maniacal children gave chase, slinging stones, most of which bounced harmlessly away. Gwen reached Roan a moment later, laying the man at his feet. The man was still gripping the frying pan tightly, a glazed, fearful look in his eyes. He was covered from head to toe in flat red spots. Mottle.
"Heal him," Gwendolyn commanded. "What about you?" he asked.
But she was already gone, off to find another victim who could still be rescued. Roan looked at the man, who was suddenly staring at him as if he were a monster, his eyes dark, his mouth an angry growl.
"Get away from me!"
he screamed. With a wicked swing, he slammed the metal pan into Roan's head. Spots danced before Roan's vision as he went down. The memory crackled through his mind like flames. The girl with the broken leg, healing her. The smell of burnt flesh, charred corpses. So small, so heart-wrenchingly small. His vision cleared, and the man screamed again, launching himself toward Roan. Roan tried to roll, but the pox seemed to strengthen his adversary, giving him supernatural speed. He clamped claw-like hands around Roan's throat, digging into his soft flesh. Roan's lifemark flared, healing his skull and his neck simultaneously, sapping his strength. He knew he could help this man, who was clearly not himself. But all he could see in the man's face were those tiny, charred corpses. All he could smell in the air was burning flesh. He remembered his guardian's warning that if he healed someone marked for death, then he would die in their place. All he could do was heal himself, and he bucked his body like a wild horse, throwing the man off. He kicked him hard in the face and took off, running through the square, heat rushing through his veins.
"Where is she? Where is she? Where is she?"
There. He spotted Gwen fighting to wrench a screaming child from the grip of two women who appeared to be trying to rip the little girl's arms off. Behind Gwen, there was another form closing in, waving a torch, lighting houses and people afire with each step. The crazed torchbearer reached for Gwen. Roan opened his mouth to warn her, but before he could, another figure streaked out from the cover of one of the intact structures, tackling the man with a heavy thump. Roan raced forward and grabbed one of the women from behind. She kicked and screamed and bit Roan's hand, but he wouldn't let go until he dragged her well clear. With only one delirious woman to contend with, Gwen broke the child loose and carried her away, shouting, "Healer! With me! With me!" Gwen wasn't aware of what had transpired behind her, how close she'd come to death. Roan looked back at the figure who had saved her, a strange creature that was now on fire, swaying and stumbling as he tried to escape the town's boundaries. It was Bark. Acting purely on instinct, Roan ran for the man with the rough skin, simultaneously ripping off his own cloak and wrapping it around him. He could feel the heat of the flames through the fabric, but refused to give them air, forcing them to die down to smoke and ash. He slung Bark's wood-like arm over his shoulders and helped him stagger through the square. Twice they were accosted by pox-afflicted villagers, and twice Roan was forced to throw Bark to the ground to fend them off with well-placed kicks. And then, abruptly, they were out of the chaos, screams and cries fading behind them. He found Gwendolyn curled up in a ball beside the child, who was crying.
"Hush, child,"
Gwen kept repeating, even as red spots erupted from her own skin. The Orion's eyes were slowly closing, but flashed open when Roan and Bark staggered and fell beside her.
"Bark, how did you... What are you... What happened?" "He saved your life,"
Roan gasped, his life mark staving off the pox.
"You didn't see, but he did."
Bark's blackened skin twitched as he tried to speak.
"My hero,"
he rasped.
"At long last, my debt is paid."
He collapsed, his eyes closing.
"No,"
Gwen screamed, which made the little girl cry harder.
"Save him! Roan! Save him!"
Roan was exhausted, and he was using his life mark to stave off the pox, which was slowly draining what little energy he had left. Plus, all three of them were marked for death now. If he healed any of them, he would die. He hesitated for only the barest of moments.
"This is it,"
he thought.
"This is my purpose. To save these lives. To sacrifice myself for something good."
"You first," he said to Gwen, determination coursing through him.
"No,"
she shouted, grabbing him by the collar. She shook him, commanding him to save Bark, to save the little girl, but nothing she did could stop Roan from using his power on her, a stream of white light arcing from his chest and into her skin. The red spots faded and then disappeared entirely. Weariness flooded Roan, and his vision grew fuzzy around the edges.
"I'm dying," he thought.
He didn't care, because he'd saved her. He'd done what he couldn't do for that little girl all those years ago. Gwen slapped Roan, hit him in the chest, and he flinched, his eyes widening.
"Not me, you fool!"
she screamed.
"Bark! Save Bark!"
Roan wondered whether he had enough strength left to save another, to make his death count for even more. His hand shaking, he reached out and touched Bark's burnt flesh, shocked at how hot it still was. His life mark probed the man, feeling nothing. He was already gone.
"I'm sorry," he said. "There's nothing to be done."
Gwen shook her head, tears sparkling in her golden eyes, which were full of anger and regret.
"The girl," she growled. "It's not too late."
Roane turned his attention toward the little girl, whose midnight hair was full of natural ringlets. She'd stopped crying and was staring at him, her eyes full of a mix of rage and fear.
"Demon,"
she breathed. She tried to swing her tiny fist at Roane's face, but he caught it, his life mark burning up his chest, giving this poor child everything he had left. When he had nothing left to give, he collapsed, and the world faded into nothingness. Roane awoke with a gasp, the pain in his chest like a burning fist repeatedly punching him.
"Where am I? Is this where souls go? Do I even have a soul?"
At first, all he saw was a grey, cloud-filled sky, but then a pair of big brown eyes, framed by tiny black ringlets of hair.
"Ugh,"
he groaned.
"He's alive,"
a tiny mouth shrieked.
"I am? But how?"
He'd saved the lives of two other people. He should be dead. The South Runner must be part Orcad, for he has more lives than good sense, another voice said. Prince Gareth. "First dragons and the plague, then a stab to the gut, and now pox. The great Orion smiles upon you."
"Of course he's alive,"
a gruff voice said. King Ironclad.
"The Royal Healer's skills are unmatched."
"I didn't do anything," another voice said. The Royal Healer, presumably. Roane blinked to find a kindly face pressing in beside the tiny sprite of a girl with the dark ringlets.
What happened?"
he asked.
"You survived the pox. That's what happened," the man said.
"A healer," the king had said.
"Of course I did,"
Roane wanted to say. The pox was no issue. But how had he survived healing Gwen and the girl? The little girl in front of him looked familiar.
Yes.
She'd lunged at him, called him a demon. She'd had the pox too, and he'd used his mark to heal her. Images sprang up, unbidden, slashing across his vision like a hot knife. Burning flesh, wisps of smoke, a pit of ash.
"Please,"
Roane said.
"Don't. Don't hurt her."
The healer frowned. "He looks awake, but he appears to be having a waking nightmare. He needs to rest."
"No,"
Roane said, squinting when Prince Gareth sidled beside the healer, his metal armor reflecting blades of sunlight. "Good, because we need to move on before the Orion tries to charge into Glee again."
"Gwendolyn?"
Roane said. He remembered healing her, but had he done enough to stave off the disease?
"She saved me,"
the little girl said.
"And then you saved me. You're my heroes. I'm Freya, and the prince let me water his horse, and I ate three bowls of soup. When can I go see my ma and da?"
Roane's head was spinning, and he was struggling to keep up with the girl's rapid changes of topic.
"Your parents?"
"Come, Freya," the healer said, ushering her away. "Roane needs to rest."
"But I—"
"You can speak to him later." As she was pushed away, Freya looked back at Roane and grinned. He couldn't help but to mirror her smile.
"Where are her parents?"
he asked, when she had gone. "Dead," Prince Gareth said, "along with her brothers and sisters. She had two of each." Roane's abdomen constricted. He remembered the horrific scenes from Glee, the violence, the killing.
"Survivors?"
Gareth's face was as somber as Roane had ever seen it. "Only Freya, unless you include you and Gwendolyn." Roane took a deep breath. He saved two people. They were alive. His guardian was dead. He wasn't going to rise from the grave and burn Freya and Gwen. As much as he knew it to be true, he couldn't stop his heart from hammering in his chest. And he was alive, despite what his guardian had told him.
A lie, he thought. My guardian lied to me so I wouldn't use my mark to save anyone. Then he remembered one other. Bark? The prince shook his head.
He was badly burned. His body was already weak from his own affliction.
He saved Gwendolyn, not me.
A flash of silver flared in the corner of his eye. Gwen appeared, her eyes stormier than he'd ever seen them.
Yes, Bark saved me. Yet you wouldn't save him.
I tried,
Roan said, feeling a pang in his chest when he remembered how lifeless the man had been when he'd touched him.
Not hard enough. Bark bore no mark, had no magic. Yet he came when no one else would.
Roan could hardly bear the anger in the Orion's eyes, but he refused to look away.
He was a hero, Roan said.
Gwendolyn spat in disgust.
That word, she said, is meaningless. People love to throw it around like a badge of honor. Bark was a hero, but that doesn't even begin to describe the man he was. He would have saved the entire town if he could have, even if it meant his own death. You, on the other hand.
She shook her head.
You are no hero, no matter what the girl says.
The words were meant to injure, but Roan felt nothing but numbness. He knew he could tell her he thought he would die if he saved her, and yet he did it anyway. But did that make him a hero?
No.
He knew. It made him tired. It made him human. But not a hero. He would never tell her the truth, not even if she tried to torture it out of him. He didn't want credit. Not when he'd wasted so many years avoiding the suffering of others. Suffering he could have relieved.
I agree, he said.
Gwen raised the edge of her lip and glared at him one last time. Then she stalked off. For once, the prince didn't laugh at Roan. For what it's worth, he said, I think you did everything you could. The prince left, and Roan noticed another, larger form lurking nearby. Beyond Stone Sledge approached, making no effort to mask his footsteps.
There is great fear in you,
the warrior said, casting a shadow across Roan's face.
Why?
Roan didn't know how to respond, so he asked a question of his own.
Why do you wear a symbol of your mark around your neck?
He asked, eyeing the chain dangling from the man's thick throat.
Because else none would know I was marked.
The concept of flaunting a mark was so foreign to Roan he was at a loss for words. Bjorn explained,
I am a warrior. A battle is almost always won or lost before it begins. The first volley is fear, and when men see the sign of me mark, they piss their breeches. I am victorious without ever landing a single blow.
That's why he mentioned the fear he saw in me, Roan realized. He thinks I'm weak. Where is your mark?
Roan asked.
On me ass.
Bjorn laughed, a sound more akin to a roar than a chuckle.
Me ma about died when she was bathing me in the firelight, and saw it blaze forth.
Roan wished he could laugh, but couldn't find it inside himself. Not when he had no memories of his own mother. He used to think he was angry at his mother for abandoning him to the south, for dying so he could live. He used to think his life wasn't worth it if his own mother had to die in his place. But now he knew those feelings were those of a scared little boy. Realization pressed in on all sides. The only way to make his mother's sacrifice worthwhile was for him to live the life he was always meant to. A life that mattered.
Have you ever feared using your mark?
Roan asked Bjorn now. Bjorn raised one dark, bushy brow.
Every day, he said,
which wasn't the answer Roan had expected.
Sometimes I'm too strong, he explained. I can hurt someone by accident when I mean to do something else.
Roan chewed on that for a moment. He understood the feeling all too well.
Have you ever killed someone by mistake?
Yes, Bjorn said. Maybe they deserved it. Maybe not. But it wasn't for me to decide. Not in this particular case. And once I drove someone away. Someone I loved.
Who?
A woman,
Bjorn said. He looked away from Roan, his expression wistful, radiating memories.
A woman I loved.
What happened?
She was special. Ida. A good name. A strong name. For a good, strong woman. We got on well, talked all the time. I was sorely tempted to touch her. She seemed to want the same. But when I wrapped my arms around her, my emotions got the better of me and I squeezed too hard. Broke her ribs. Snapped a couple bones in her back. She never wanted to see me again.
His eyes ratcheted back to meet Roan's stare, his expression dark and steely.
Love's not for me. Not anymore. I'm here for one thing, and one thing only. War.
With that said, Bjorn Stonesledge lumbered away, one hand playing with his iron necklace.
Wait,
Roan said, urging his horse forward. When the battalion had started moving again, Roan had sought out the Orion, but Gwen was already well ahead of the column, galloping toward the ever-darkening horizon. Her eyes were focused forward, as if she couldn't bear to look back at the plumes of storm-black smoke erupting from the town of Glee. They'd burned the entire town to the ground to ensure the disease was eradicated. Gwen charged forward, away from Roan. He gave chase, his horse's hoofbeats like thunder on the road, which had become stony and hard. To his surprise, he seemed to be gaining on her, though she was a far superior rider, and her steed normally ran like the wind. He pulled astride, glancing over. Her intentions registered a moment too late for him to react. She threw herself from her horse, slamming her shoulder into his chest. He toppled from his mount, grunting as she landed atop him, and all air left his lungs. She pinned him to the ground, needlessly. He couldn't even breathe, much less fight back. As he wheezed, she said,
"They'll call you a hero because you healed that girl. But you're not. Nor am I. She was one soul amongst hundreds of innocents. We failed them, you and I. We failed Bark. We failed ourselves."
Roan tried to respond, but could only issue a ragged wheeze. Gwen bit her lip, and the anger seemed to leave her. Her shoulders slumped, and a single tear slipped from her eye, meandering down her cheek. It was liquid silver. She rolled off of him, and for a few moments all he could hear was the sound of her breathing and his own wheezing as he struggled to regain his breath. When he felt he could speak again, he said,
"What happened with you and Bark? Why is he so important to you?"
Gwen's eyes shot to his, and then darted away.
"I'm surprised Gareth hasn't told you. He said to ask you. He said you saved Bark's life. That's why he always called you his hero."
Gwen laughed without mirth.
"I saved Bark's life, yes. But only after he saved a dozen others. Ever since I've known him, he's been a talented blacksmith. Years ago, he had travelled south to Hammerton to sell his wares. I was there, gathering information for the king on the war effort. Not Oren, but his father, Hamworth. At the time, the Phoenicians had been pushing across the Spear and attacking Hammerton."
She paused, and Roan sensed she was gathering her thoughts. He waited patiently.
"An attack came, but not from the Phoenicians. From the Calypsians, who had managed to sail a fleet of small warships across the burning sea and up the Spear, undetected. They set fire to the city, pouring hot oil from the walls, which they had scaled under the cover of night. Flaming arrows fell upon us like falling red stars. Sadly, most of the soldiers fled rather than fought. Later, they faced the king's wrath for cowardice in battle. Bark did not flee, though he was not a soldier. He saved many lives, men, women, children. I even saw him carry a hound away from the smoke and flames. And yet, like me, he kept going back to save others. He didn't bear a mark, like me. But that didn't stop him. Eventually I had to pull him away, because there was no one else to save. The others all dead.
No one but him, of course. From that day forward, he refused to call me anything but a hero. But it was he, not I, who was a hero that day. He who had a choice. And still he risked his life for the sake of another. When the tale was finished, she looked right at Roane. You are nothing like him. Roane felt his cheeks turn red, but it wasn't from embarrassment. It was because the truth was like a hot sun beating down on him, burning his skin. I never said I was a hero. I'm not. I never will be. The unsteadiness in his voice only served to help make his point. Is that the truth? Because you never seem to say what you mean. Truth swelled on his tongue, but Roane swallowed the words back down. He couldn't say what he wanted to. Didn't know how. He only said, Yes, it's the truth. Gwen growled. How long did you live in the West? Who are you, really? I know a lie when I hear one, and your tongue is full of deceit. Roane wanted to tell her truly, but he couldn't, for it would mean his death if she passed the information on to King Ironclad. Gwen spat in the dirt. I thought you were different. I've never met someone with a mark like yours, like mine. Something used to help people. Bjorn Stonesledge only uses his iron mark for killing. Then there's the Ice Lord in the north, Fire Sands and her damn firemark in Calypso, and the Slave King, Vin Hosa, in Fanes. Their marks are used for terror, for power, for control. You could be different. You should be different. But he wasn't. I'm sorry, Roane said, hating every word crowding inside his mouth, hating how true they were, how pathetic. You don't know me, what I've done. I cannot do what you ask of me. He wanted to tell her about the dead girl haunting his dreams in the dark of night, but he knew it would only sound like another excuse, and he was done with excuses. And you think you know what I've done? Gwen said, her voice rising. What I've lost. You don't know a damn thing about me. It wasn't the response Roane expected. Tell me about your bondmate, the poet soldier. She shook her head, grimacing. She stood up, not bothering to look at him, and remounted her horse, which had stopped when she'd leapt off. She galloped away toward the sunset. 23. The Western Kingdom, on the road to Talis. Greece Jolly. Greece Jolly stumbled along the southern road. His stump was throbbing something fierce. No, he thought. Not my stump. My hand. Which made him crazy, or delirious, or both. Because he didn't have a second hand. The Furies had made sure of that. And yet, he could still feel it. He could feel the aching in each individual bone in his hand, his fingers. My hand hurts. God's damn madness, Greece muttered. But still he staggered onward, because they had his sister, a fact that was far worse and more painful than losing a hand. One question kept bobbing around in his mind, like a makeshift raft on the open sea. Why? Why was Shay still alive, despite being marked an enemy to the kingdom? Why had the Furies abducted her? And where in the cursed Western Kingdom were they taking her? He'd been following the dirt track for hours, long after the sun had breached the horizon's defences and fought its way into the sky. Though the impressions weren't deep, Greece had no trouble following the hoofprints left by the Furious horses as they'd fled night's end. This is her fault, Greece thought, trying to convince himself once more. He wanted someone to blame, someone to curse, but try as he might, he couldn't. Princess Rhea's actions had been rash and unjustified, but what he'd done to her had been awful, too. Seeing her at the end, so destroyed by her father's death, had nearly wrenched his heart from his chest. He jammed his bloody stump against his forehead, his mind clearing as pain lanced up his arm. My fault, he said, the words chasing the princess, who he'd likely never see again, from his mind. He'd promised his parents that he would protect Shay, and now she was in grave danger because of his own stupidity, which left him with only one choice. Get her back.